Praise the Lord. Jesus, in the name of the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Amen. I'm going to sing Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound.
Amazing Grace.
I want people to sing with me too.
Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound.
To you. It is 24 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of July, in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming by, making it part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We are live for Tuesday. I'm sorry, is it Tuesday? Is it Monday? What day is
it? I'm sorry, it is Monday.
All right, it is Monday, July 5th. 2010, this is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, an excursion into whimsy. Thank you for joining us. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor. If you would like to be part of our program today, telephonically or otherwise, there are myriad ways in which you can do so. It is 503-505-6964. You'd like to join us, 503-505-6964. 6-4, that is our telephone number on this fine Monday. While everyone else is peddling the same old whatnot, the same old tedium, the same old dreck, the same old schlarp at you, this is a brand new broadcast. It's 503-505-6964, 6964, and the great on-turning of the phone has now happened. There we go. Excellent. If you'd like to email, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. You can also join us in the chat box today. It is happening live right now at rickemerson.com, the website. In mere moments, we will go to the news desk where Dawn Taylor will favor you with stories, including but not limited to the following. Dawn, what is a sampling of the headlines we'll be giving to the good people of Portland and beyond today?
Well, Terry Horman has been accused in a murder plot. A family locked a scientist in a coffin for 2 years. We will have a Britney watch, a corpse watch, and a penis watch.
Fantastic. That is all on the way today, as well as our good friend Siegfried, who's going to be in the studio talking about Grindhouse Trailer Mania 2, which is going to be playing at the Hollywood Theater. And I said this last hour, actually, during Legion of News, but the guy who requested the Erotic Adventures of Zorro trailer to begin the show, you, sir, will get your wish tomorrow on Tuesday. We will begin the program with that. It's like 9 minutes long. It just goes on forever, though, so I got to cut it down. So that's coming up later on today. David Walker from badassmofo.com will be joining us. And so forth. And then we've got the hope. I've got voicemails to get through. I got this insane sound from Nancy Grace. She's become my new favorite thing, by the way. There was a moment where it was that other guy on CNN, that dick whose name I forget. He was some guy on Headline News. He was the guy who asked the question about when are teachers going to learn that they can't have sex with their children? And the answer, by the way, is apparently never. It's just the evidence indicates it's not going to happen anytime soon. But Nancy Grace has once again reclaimed the crown, so we'll get to that. We've got some coverage of this whole thing that happened with Joey Chestnut and Kobayashi at the Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest yesterday, where Kobayashi, which I think Chestnut actually predicted ahead of time, he said that he thought he was going to show up because it had been some sort of. And the thing is, I don't really understand the backstory, but I don't even really know how important it is to understand the back. I don't know how much underpinning you really need to sort of get the humor of the whole thing. So we'll talk about that. It was all over the television yesterday, so we'll get to that as well. It is 503-505-6964. I will say before we do anything else here that, again, we are live. It is Monday, July 5th, and two shows in a row, Legion of News. And today we got a bit of a late start. I have this whole thing where the headphone jack on my computer is giving me a little bit of trouble, which is putting us disproportionately behind time. But we are here now, which is what matters. And not only that, we are here from inside a studio that has been, I would say, over the course of the weekend, completely renovated. If only Carl Click had seen this studio in this condition, he wouldn't have mocked us then.
No.
I have to give massive amounts of credit to my wife, by the way. I was here last night working on a whole bunch of stuff and trying to dig myself out of this massive email pile that has happened over the last the week or two. It just seems like it's just been forever since my inbox has been at zero. So I was here last night, and we were sort of endeavoring to get ourselves caught up on everything. And while I was working on that, so Lars going around the room with a staple gun and our soundproofing, actually getting it all put up. So as Dawn said, you came in the studio today, and you said that it... What did you describe it as? You said it you were like in some teenage...
teenage goth boy's dream bedroom.
Because I figured that when in doubt, you just cover everything in black. Yeah, it gives it sort of a nice a neutral look that I have. So,
it's actually very almost fancy because how you go into a room where they've upholstered their walls in fabric rather than just regular wallpaper. We have beautiful black.
It is not only beautiful; it's functional. It's sleek, it's stylish, and it absorbs it absorbs all of the sound that otherwise would make us sound like we are broadcasting you from inside a cereal box.
And Laura actually purchased for us these draperies to hang on the walls over the padding.
And by the way,
they're striped, but it's black on black, so it's like a textured stripe. So it's actually very nice.
And I should note that lamp in the corner cost $1.50. So
it's one of those fancy floor lamps with a rice paper.
But I think she got it out of a dump or something. So there's actually going to be a different shade put on that later on in the week. All right. So coming up later on, David Walker will join us. Our friend Siegfried will be here. We've got myriad watches coming up for you. We've got the Kobayashi sound to get to and so forth. At the news desk, this, however, is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A landscaper has told Multnomah County detectives that the stepmother of missing 7-year-old Kyron Horman offered him money to kill her husband. Terry Horman made the offer of a large sum of money to the landscaper 7 months ago, sources said. The source told KGW News that she approached the landscaper who had been working on their property in Northwest Portland and asked him if he would kill her husband. Kane Horman learned of the plot from investigators who said she may have tried to hire other people, too.
She may have tried to hire. That seems like it's either a yes or a no. You either tried to hire a whole bunch of guys to kill your husband, allegedly, or you did not. It seems like it's a binary situation.
Now, the guy at the meat market wouldn't do it. I'll try the landscaper.
But, I mean, where did you... Where did you go before you went to the landscaper? That's exactly it's my question. It's like who had turned you down? Like some cabbie that was taken into the airport? And had the landscaper been working for them for a long time? I mean, was it did she have some sort of ongoing? Did she have some reason to believe that this is a thing the landscaper would do? Because
maybe Kane Horman is one of those guys that is just really mean to the help. So she figured the landscaper doesn't like him.
It is hard to get good assistants around the house. I can't even, Lauren and I can't even find somebody to come in and take the dogs out for a walk a couple times a week, much less, to kill a guy and then dispatch him accordingly. So, all right. So it is alleged that she tried to have her husband taken care of, which the cops then told him, right? That was the thing where they went over to the house and they said, hey, guess what your wife was doing last week? And he said, I don't know. And they said, trying to have you killed. And he said, no way. And they said, yes, with the landscaper. And then he was on the phone immediately filing for divorce.
Pretty much,
so,
yes.
All right, awesome. So that story continues to get better with every passing day.
And I believe you have some exciting Nancy Grace audio
to go
with this.
So here is the thing about Nancy Grace is... It, as we noted, I think it is last week we were talking about this. Pardon me, I have to clear my throat. As we noted last week, she's not really capable of conveying or summoning up actual, real, convincing emotions. So what she does is she just...
Now we know why.
Well, she just says everything. She says everything much more loudly. That's the Nancy Grace method, is that if you can't actually... If you can't actually speak with any sort of empathy... You just sort of shout everything really, really, really intensely like this, and then it sounds as though you are concerned about the story.
She's the female Bill Compton.
She kind of is. I mean, that's the thing I figured out, is that she just does the True Blood technique of raising her volume level.
The louder it is... The more sincere
the more
it
you
must
feel
be.
It. That's it. It yes. must be true. So this is Nancy Grace talking about this case of Kyron Horman last week. I've got the four cuts on this. Let's roll this first one right out of the gate here.
The natural mother taking to the public media, begging the stepmother to please help police. Please come clean. Please cooperate. Breaking down in tears as she vows her 7-year-old little boy is still alive. Straight out to Kevin Miller, investigative reporter. Kevin, what's the latest?
So she throws it to this guy, and he's there, and he's listening to the earpiece, and she's sort of looking very, very intently into the camera, trying to get to the bottom of this. And meanwhile, I'm like scrambling to turn the TiVo on because
Nancy, today at Brooks Historic Church, Desiree Young had a show of unity, a show of confidence, and a show of concern, a show of unity with her husband and Kane Horman, Kyron's natural father, saying that they believe that Kyron is still alive. We believe he's alive. Imploring people at this news conference to get the word out, to let everyone know that Kyron is still missing, but they believe he's alive. And Nancy, yes, as you've said, Desiree Young and the others said, we implore Terry Horman to fully cooperate with investigators to bring Kyron home. They've said they're cooperating with investigators. They want her to cooperate, not right now, Nancy.
So this, I think, was the this is the press conference that happened. I guess it must have been a Friday afternoon or maybe Friday morning that this took place, because they're covering it. And then she starts talking to the guy about, what does the family believe, and what if the cops told them? And then it leads up, I believe it's this cut to this. This is the money line. This is when I knew we had to play.
Okay, but if he's still alive, Kevin Miller, where does that leave me? Since we know the police focus is now on stepmommy, Terry Horman. If he's still alive, what would be their working theory? Did she sell him?
Yes, she sold him, Nancy Grace. That's exactly what she did. The police are believing that he was, in fact, parceled out to a man for a carton of smokes.
Interesting that that's the first thing she goes to.
That's my thing. It's like, where would you get that? On the list of possible outcomes for what happened to Kyron Horman, even if you are, nuts, where is it that you would immediately come up with, did they sell him? Let's listen to that one more time, shall we?
Okay, but if he's still alive, Kevin Miller, where does that leave me? Since we know the police focus is now on stepmommy, Terry Horman, if he's still alive, what would be their working theory? Did she sell him? Did she give him away? I mean, where are they going with the theory that he's still alive, Kevin Miller?
And she ends everything, and I understand why she does this. This is sort of a radio trick where when you introduce somebody, you use their full name. And that's so somebody who has just tuned in knows who you're talking to. But the thing is, you know, it's television. You don't really need to do that. Like, it says Kevin Miller on the bottom of the screen. So when
I like the idea that maybe she just does that all the time. Like, when she's in the office talking to her assistants. She's like, "And where is my lunch, Susan Jones?"
"You, Janice McClarsky, where is my bagel?" So she throws it back to Kevin, and he, at this point, is looking a little bit. He's looking a little bit unsure of how to proceed, because it's like having a conversation with an air horn. I think,
Nancy, they believe that Terry Horman has these answers, and again, based on the 911 calls, based on the husband moving out, based on the fact that, again, they're not releasing any information. And the parents believe this because they have to. They have that undying love for baby Kyron, and they have to believe that he's coming home. That's where they get their belief from.
Isn't
and again,
like
they
he's
want
seven.
Terry Horman or
yeah.
whoever has Kyron to let him come home.
So, Kevin Miller, are you telling me that... From your analysis.
I mean, why would you? What is the point of continually using his full name like that? It says his name on the screen in letters like 5 inches high. Also, and I'm not really trying to make light of the situation, but it is interesting to hear them trying to use that for the baby Kyron phrase as though that is a thing that they themselves are trying to inject into the lexicon, into the discourse. Like that's going to be sort of their trademark on it. Is they're going to refer to him as baby Kyron. That is their contribution to this.
Like he's trapped in a well.
Exactly. So let me just
maybe
get back to this.
Maybe he is trapped in a well.
Get back to have we checked the wells
in the area?
Has anyone
looked at the wells?
Let me get won't somebody please think of the wells. So let me get back to this. We'll finish this final cut here.
They want Terry Horman or whoever has Kyron to let him come home.
So, Kevin Miller, are you telling me that from your analysis, they want to believe he's alive or police have led them to believe he's alive?
I believe that they want to believe that he's alive, and that's their hope for continuing on. And they have spoken very highly of the police, so they believe that the police know the answers.
So here's the thing. The upshot of all this is that Nancy Grace has now become a thing I have to tape and watch every single night, which I wouldn't really – you know, I thought at the time where I could be amused or shocked or surprised by things on television, I thought that maybe that ship had sailed. But I'd like to thank her for renewing my hope in the entertainment value of television and television news.
I like that she actually raises the questions. Do the parents want to believe that he's alive?
No, it's all about the.
Okay, but if he's still alive, Kevin Miller, where does that leave me? Since we know the police focus is now on stepmommy, Terry Horman. If he's still alive, what would be their working theory? Did she sell him? Did she give him away?
For how much was he sold? Was it at a discount? Was there any haggling involved?
You know, a therapist would probably have some interesting things to say about her phrasing there.
Yes.
Like, well, if he's still alive, where does that leave me?
Where does that leave me, Nancy Grace?
Kevin Miller.
Yeah. So she has supplanted this guy.
When will teachers finally understand it's not okay to have sex with our students?
It really is just what... It's just one big endless parade of amusements on television lately. Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
I have a Britney Spears watch, if I should have waved this at you.
A Britney watch, really?
Well, I have been actually, yeah. There's been a lot of Britney in the news, actually, lately. It's just...
I actually have to say...
It's more an accumulation of news rather than any one really great thing.
I actually have to say that is the one watch that I believe I am unprepared for. Because
as
I was going through it, I'll dig it up for later. As we were... well, good. You have a corpse watch instead, so
we can do the corpse
watch. We'll slot that one in. Okay. Of all of the watches... that you could have picked. That was actually the one over the weekend when I was either refining all my sound and going through my archives. I actually said, "Well, I clearly have no need for this." The Britney watch is actually, you know where that is? That's on the same pile of stuff as my Jennifer Lopez watch, because I just thought, "Well, that had some amusement value for a while. Now we've moved on."
Well, we can pass on it without any. The interesting thing about the Britney news is just that it's been trickling out constantly. you know, it's just stuff about her kids and about custody of her kids and about what she's doing with her kids. So it's not one, it's still not any real good, like, head shaving crazy, but like this constant stream of Britney all of a sudden again.
Well, it's one of those things where once she got out of the nuttery, I just sort of assumed that we were never going to have anything entertaining from her ever again, because that was when the dad, Jamie Spears, I think, that's when the dad just decided that he was going to take over, and he became the, whatever he called, the executor or whatever, the account. And it seemed like the days of Britney just being flat out screaming nuts were probably at an end. And I was poorer for it, by the way, as were we all. So much as I would like to believe that she's going to go bonkers again, it is the Rick Emerson radio program. It is Monday, July 5th, 2010. It is time to have a corpse watch. So everyone, gather around the wireless, won't you please? This is the Rick Emerson Show.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
Here is Don Taylor with your corpse watch for Monday.
A convicted drug dealer who kept his girlfriend's body preserved on dry ice in a swank Newport Beach hotel room for a year has been deported to his native New Zealand
after
being released from prison.
His hotel room on dry ice.
It's a gift
to shreds, you say. Okay, I was going to jump in with a bunch of questions, but A, I realize that you're not a pathologist, and also you only got like a sentence of the story out before I immediately jumped in and demanded answers from you like Nancy Grace.
Hopefully your questions will be answered.
Did he defile it, Don Taylor? Where am I, Rick Emerson, to go with this?
Stephen David Royds, who went by the nickname Kiwi.
His last name is Royds?
Yeah, R-O-Y-D-S.
All right, okay.
Was arrested in March 2008 by Newport Beach police officers. Authorities had been investigating reports that he was selling cocaine at a local bar. After his arrest, police searched his room at the Fairmont Hotel, where he'd been living for 2 years. Officers found the frozen body of Monique Tripp, 33. She had been stuffed into a plastic box filled with dry ice. Royds told the Orange County Register that Tripp's death was related to religion. Everything that happened was for religious reasons, he said repeatedly. A spokeswoman for the hotel declined to confirm that Royds had been living there for as long as 3 years. The four-star hotel boasts lush grounds, restaurants serving California cuisine, and a prime location near John Wayne Airport.
All right, I really do have to stop at this point. First of all, I'll skip the whole thing about the Royds and whatever to go right to the fact that his nickname is Kiwi.
Because he was from New Zealand.
Of course.
That's like the dumbest nickname ever. I would like to also point out, Larry, he also called himself Mel Stephen Prophet.
I don't think that's a nickname.
That's the name of a character from Wise Guy, played by Kevin Spacey.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, but that's actually interesting, as opposed to the Kiwi thing is just dumb. Actually, calling yourself after that, at least he's breaking new ground there. I was just back on the whole thing of Kiwi and... We'll leave aside the cliche of him being from the New Zealand and whatever. I'm wondering whether he gave himself that nickname, whether his girlfriend gave him that name, whether just some American lunkhead gave him the name. And really, this is all leading up to whether or not his girlfriend called him Kiwi while they were having sex. Because that's a thing I can't really imagine somebody screaming out at a moment about, oh, Kiwi, give me every inch of your love, Kiwi, as only you can.
Well, and it's a terrible nickname because it's like being American and being in another country and your nickname is
Yank. Yeah, exactly.
You know, or you're here and you're from Australia and your nickname is Aussie.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dumb nickname.
It really is. So he kept her body on dry ice in his hotel room. I have, I think, seven questions about this. One.
Well, oh, go ahead.
Before we get any further, because it's just going to lead to more queries on my
part. There are so many delicious details to this story, by the way.
I am always fascinated by people who live in a hotel for years on end, sort of Sid and Nancy style. That is the thing that I think you have to be one of two categories to do that. You're either really poor or you're really rich. If you're living in a hotel, like in New Brunswick or something, you know, you're probably closer to the end of your life than the beginning for one reason or another. And it's some sort of a flop house where a guy who has one of those like larynx boxes, one of those your rent is due things, it's behind bulletproof glass and you have to pay $4 a night and there's like a communal shower down the hall that costs a nickel. or you are, you know, one of those guys who, you know, you get dumped by your wife in Manhattan, and rather than go find property to buy, you just go stay at the Four Seasons every night at a cost of however many thousands of dollars a month. This guy sounds like he's closer to the latter category. I'm also intrigued by the idea that he kept her body on dry ice for a year. Where is it that you're going to buy enough dry ice to preserve somebody? That's a lot of dry ice. I wouldn't know where to go buy
you're
it.
You're buying dry ice, I think, daily at that point.
Who sells you dry ice?
Do you think someone would notice him bringing it in and out of the hotel room?
What's that smoking container you're bringing in, sir? Nothing. It's incense.
Well, Royds, 46, has a history of fleeing the law and uses multiple aliases, including Mel Prophet, based on the character from Wise Guy.
Fantastic.
Royds' hotel room was so full of drug paraphernalia and wrapped Christmas presents that police found it hard to walk around. Maids cleaned the room where the body lay in dry ice. So maids had been in and out. Royds had pleaded not guilty to one count of the sale or transport of a controlled substance and one count of possession of a controlled substance with intent to sell. An autopsy concluded that Trepp's death was not a homicide, and Royds has not been charged in her death. Toxicology reports were pending, but Dennis Conway, an assistant district attorney, said it appeared Trepp had died of an overdose. Royds had been dating Trepp, who was charged with several felonies in Colorado in 2005, including possession of a controlled substance with intent to sell. Royds is being held without bail because of a 2002 conviction on several felony drug counts in which he never turned himself in after being sentenced to 6 months in jail. Police have not said how long the body was kept in the room. The Orange County Register reported that Trepp may have been dead for a year. Royds appeared in court on Monday. He said, "Yes, sir," when asked by the judge if he understood the charges, but was otherwise silent.
At what point do you suppose he started working through exactly how it was he was going to keep her body around for a year? And was his plan just to continue this ad infinitum, or was there a step B at some point?
And he kept repeating, apparently, everything that happened was for religious reasons,
yes,
but without actually explaining that. I did like... He was arrested in March of 2008, but yet the room was full of drug paraphernalia and wrapped Christmas presents.
Yeah, no, that's a little bit of a creepy touch there. That's something they put in the story just to unnerve me, Rick Emerson. All right, that was your corpse watch for Monday, July 5th, 2010, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. I'm resurrecting memories of a love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
And this is all true. We'll do a couple more here, then we'll take a break. We'll have Pop Culture Authority. Today's installment of Pop Culture Authority answers the magic question, what is with that number 33 that's on the side of Rolling Rock bottles? So we'll do that here in a few. Then after that, we will welcome to the studio our good friend Siegfried to talk about Grindhouse Trailer Mania 2, which will be playing at the Hollywood Theater soon. And David Walker from BadassMofo.com will be joining us to discuss that as well later on. More news. I got to get these voicemails so forth, and then somebody has sent me. I got a long list of emails I got through, but somebody sent me the greatest science question. So we'll get all of that is on the way. This is Don Taylor at the news desk.
The Japanese eating champion who sat out this year's Coney Island 4th of July hot dog contest was jailed overnight for disrupting the event. Competitive eater Joey Jaws Chestnut ate his way to a fourth consecutive championship Sunday, but he was upstaged by the surprise appearance of his biggest rival, six-time champion Tokiro Kobayashi, who did not compete, but rushed the stage instead.
So let me just back up for 1 second, because there was some discussion of this last Friday, but I never really got all the details. There's some sort of contractual, there's like a contractual dispute, or there was some sort of a litigation-based squabble that was going on, which is why he didn't show up.
I don't have it right in front of me. I think what happened was Kobayashi competed in a non-sanctioned eating event.
Okay, so this is where he went off the reservation somehow.
Right, and all of these major league eater guys have contracts with this major league eating organization, and so they're barred from participating in anything that is not an MLE event.
All right, so he violated some sort of exclusivity
right
order. That's what this is about, because Chestnut had made some reference to the fact that he said, well, we all work for the same organization. He ought to just show up. This is last week when they it didn't look like he was going to be there at all. And Chestnut said, well, he ought to just be there. There's no reason for him to skip it. And I was never really clear what the whole ruckus was about. But then I think Chestnut actually ended that news story last week by saying that he thought Kobayashi was just going to show up, at the last moment. But I don't think anybody anticipated he was going to show up this way. So,
but this whole thing, just doesn't this all have like a professional wrestling kind of stunt quality to it?
But here's that was going to be my next thing. My next question was going to be, is there how am I trying to put this? It's illegal to rig. I'm not saying this is rigged, by the way, and I'm not saying the outcome of the contest itself is rigged, but. So I'm not implying that because it doesn't seem like this impacted that one way or the other, except in as much as Kobayashi didn't compete. But it's illegal to have certain things happen at sanctioned sporting events if they are presented as reality when they are not, isn't it? I mean, it's like you couldn't just have some guy charge the ring at a regular boxing match. Because, first of all, I think there's wagering that happens on, like legally sanctioned wagering that happens on it. So I don't know. Like but
is Major League Eating is this like
is it a sport
really is really a sport or is this a corporation?
If ballroom dancing
that
is a sport,
is called Major League Eating.
If synchronized swimming is a sport, eating is a sport.
I mean WWE. I mean it's
also
a
sport,
ostensibly a sport.
It is.
I honestly think that the Major League Eating thing is modeled a bit more on the wrestling model than it is. Other sports.
I'm just trying to figure out if there's...
They own every single competitor. Every competitor has to compete in events that they themselves put on and promote.
Well, that is the great sort of Don King-esque thing about it. It's like, it's the guy who owns the razor and the blades and your face and sells everything. But I am fascinated by the whole notion of money being wagered on this because, again, if you go to Vegas, you go to like a sports book in Vegas and you're rolling your eyes at me like
no,
it's
money
not...
is money is wagered in Vegas on everything.
Yeah, well, but I understand that. But I'm saying it's not. But it is. But I'm not talking about between just two guys where there's two guys sitting on the couch. One guy goes, I'll bet you $5 that Kobayashi takes it or whatever. If you go to Vegas and you go into a sports book and there's a legally sanctioned line on a boxing match, you lay down your money based on specific odds and based on the assessment of experts of who the match likely favors and who the victor in the match will be. So if you're then watching the boxing match and Don King has arranged for a guy in a Godzilla suit just to parachute out of the sky and land in the middle of the ring, the money has been lost that was wagered based on events that did not take that into calculation. It seems like there would be then some sort of lawsuit that could be filed.
But there is a boxing commission that oversees boxing.
I could have this conversation all day. This just fascinates me.
I don't think that there's a professional eating commission.
Aha, but you don't know. Is there?
Well, no, because there's just the one organization, for one thing, Major League Eating. And if you're going to go by betting, I mean, they lay odds on everything in Vegas. One of the Royals has a baby, and there are people laying odds on whether or not it comes out with flippers.
It's going to bug me forever. We got to figure this out. I'm endeavoring to do this by. I had an email about this that I was going to get to. A guy sent me an email this morning about this whole thing, saying that he had almost bet on it, but he's glad he didn't because it just seems like there was, as you said, something amiss. Now, I didn't see the actual event when it transpired. When did Kobayashi show up? In other words, was it in the middle of the actual contest it was happening? Before it even started, or was it after?
No, it was after Chestnut was...
So everything had already happened.
Everything had already happened.
Do you think the actual thing of Kobayashi not even competing was itself part of the setup in your world?
In my world, I would imagine that perhaps there was an issue. Again, the whole thing could have been a setup from the beginning because, the one guy basically owns Major League Eating and Kobayashi is an employee of his. On the other hand, it could be that the contract dispute was legitimate, but then he said, we could take advantage of this.
These lemons could be made into something else that was more palatable.
Yeah.
All right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505 6964 if you would like to join us today. Coming up at 2 o'clock, we will talk to Mr. David Walker of BadassMofo.com, as well as our good friend Siegfried, who will talk to us about the Grindhouse Trailer Mania special, which is coming up at the Hollywood Theater later on. Today's top five misinterpreted rock songs. And we have the Britney watch, and we have a third watch coming up later on
today. We
have a penis watch.
I wrote them on the board right there.
Oh, so you did. It just says Britney corpse penis, which is a sort of modern. That's our whiskey tango foxtrot. Britney watch coming up later on. Penis watch coming up as well, and whatnot. Don't forget, if you are a listener to the Rick Emerson Show and you would like to share this magical experience with a friend, colleague, loved one, casual sex partner, what have you, you can do so by going to rickemerson.com/gift. And you can give a gift subscription to this very fine radio program for the low, low price. And it really is low. Sometimes guys say low, low price. This is just a figurative low. Now, this is an actual, it's not just relatively low. It is, in fact, objectively scant, the amount of money you're being asked to spend on this. 32 cents a day. You can do that at rickemerson.com/gift and so forth. It is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. We've also got today's installment of Pop Culture Authority, answering the magic question, why the 33 on the side of Rolling Rock? This is the Rick Emerson radio program on the Emerson News Network.
Why is the number 33 on every bottle of Rolling Rock beer?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. Should you hoist a refreshing bottle of Rolling Rock beer, you might notice the number 33 printed prominently on the bottle. Many people believe that the number marks the repeal of Prohibition in 1933. Although why Rolling Rock, which was first brewed by Pennsylvania's Latrobe Brewing Company in 1939, would mark that date, is a puzzler. According to the fine folks at Snopes.com, theories about the 33 on the bottle include, but are not limited to, the following. It took 33 steps to get from the brewmaster's office to the brewing floor. The owner bet $33 on a horse and bought the brewery with the proceeds in 1933. There are 33 streams feeding into the reservoir from which the brewery draws its water. Beer tastes best at 33 degrees. It's related to the highest level. And best of all, Groundhog Day is the 33rd day of the year, and Groundhog Day is a big deal in Pennsylvania. However, according to James L., former CEO of Latrobe Brewing, the 33 signifies the 33 words in the beer's original pledge of quality, which is still printed on every bottle. Rolling Rock, from the glass-lined tanks of old Latrobe, we tender this premium beer for your enjoyment as a tribute to your good taste. It comes from the mountain springs to you. One of Rolling Rock's founders reportedly wrote 33 at the end of the slogan to indicate the number of words to the bottle's printers. They thought it was part of the text and incorporated it into the label's So the first batch of bottles carried number 33, and since they were collected, cleaned, and refilled again and again, it stayed that way. So there you have it. No Freemasons, no Prohibition, no Groundhog Day. As with many mysteries, the 33 on the Rolling Rock bottle exists for the most insane of reasons. Simple human error.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
Just
is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us on this 4th of July Monday. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. And I believe we actually have a call coming in right now. Hello, Rick Emerson Radio Program. Who might this be on this July 5th?
David Walker.
Hello, David Walker. How are you on this Monday, my friend? How is life treating you?
I'm doing wonderful, and you?
I am great. We were here last night, and when I say me, I mean me. I was here doing some work, and I had this my vantage point here. Well, you've been in the studio. The vantage point from where I sit and do the show, I'm actually next to a window that looks out onto the street, and down on the street, the guys who work elsewhere in this building, they'd acquired a substantial amount of what I'm almost certain were entirely legal fireworks that just so happened to be extraordinarily powerful. And I do believe at one point one of those fireworks, while I was here answering email, just slammed into the window while I was sort of, and it was, by that point, it was just pitch black outside. I couldn't really see anything. So I'm just sitting here at the desk. And then an incendiary device of some kind of goes poof, right into the – and it turns out that they actually own the entire joint, so it's not like it's a huge deal or whatever. But that was really the highlight of my night was actually – it was actually typing away while explosive devices landed about 6 inches next to my head. Are you a 4th of July enthusiast, David Walker?
Not in the slightest, no. It's just, another excuse for people to get drunk. And in this case, light off dangerous explosives. And those are, again, in David Walker's world, two bad tastes that don't taste good together.
See, that's the thing. You clearly have never done a news-based program because you know that if you spend your if you make your living regaling listeners with tales of the human experience in all its many forms, you know that alcohol and fireworks, in fact, alcohol and anything that is either explosive or pointy or sharp in any way, that really is where you're that's really where your humor lives. In fact, I think we have, we'll get to this later on, I think I have a story about a guy not too far from here that managed to blow off not just his hands, but in fact one whole arm over the weekend. So we'll get to that in just a few. Also joining us here in the studio is our good friend Siegfried, who has come on the program many times to talk about things of a filmic nature. Siegfried, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
You guys are actually sort of here at the same time, and it's fortuitous because you, Siegfried, are talking about Grindhouse. Is it Trailer Mania? Am I calling it the right thing?
Yes.
Am I giving it the wrong
thing? Trailer Spectacular.
And so this is just nothing but, it's like an hour or something, or 90 minutes of just trailers for old Grindhouse
That's
films.
That's correct. So, yeah, it's 7:30 this Wednesday at the Hollywood Theater is the Grindhouse Spectacular 2. We've done it before.
Is this the...
Dan's put together like a great collection of
I was
stuff.
Gonna ask if this was the second one altogether because I think I saw the first one, which contained I'm trying to remember the trailer at the first one that really stood out. It was like a Pam Grier film, but it was like Pam Grier in she had to be like a Roman she had to fight like in the Colosseum or something for
yes.
the amusement of Romans.
Yeah.
Does this film sound familiar to anyone?
That would be Arena.
Arena is pretty great. The one I loved of that last one was Rape Killer. That one.
What's
was,
it about?
It's pretty much. I mean, it's like the most uncomfortable, awkward trailer. Like you, it's just it's like it's what it is. Like you're
there's some rape and there's some
rape,
killing,
and it's just all it goes is there's this guy who goes rapes and then it goes Rape Killer. And you're like, what? Like, what is this? Who made this? It's like the ultimate, like, teaser trailer. And
Now, does he kill them with rape? Or is he killed because he's a rapist?
That was a big question.
Well, it's a cliffhanger. Like, if they give you a fish, Don, you don't have to go learn to fish.
That one, I haven't seen it. Because, yeah, does he kill the rapist or he raped the killer? I'm not sure. Yet.
I remember, speaking of, and for those who maybe have only seen, like the Tarantino and Rodriguez film called Grindhouse is a sort of genre film. It's I don't know if there's really a difference, but when I was growing up, we called them B movies, and I guess they're not quite the same thing. Grindhouse movies are sort of B movies that lean much more heavily on sex and violence.
To me, I have like a different like terminology of it than compared to like probably David Walker's got like a different terminology of it too. To me, like personally, like I think it's just it's the stuff that's just so cool, like from the '60s, '70s, and '80s, and usually they're kind of an exploitative sort of realm. You got like Hicksploitation, samurai films, the Shaw Brothers films. You have samurai vengeance, zombie movies. You have all that, and it's just, to me, it's just the stuff that is cool. And but you have like blaxploitation. You have the a wide range. But you know, like I'm almost kind of seeing like there is some kind of it's hard to determine what is grindhouse and what's not. But the major like sticking point that like is whether or not it's cool.
And the double bill that you guys did last year, which was the what was the zombie double bill that was at the Hollywood? It was I think it was like zombie, and then it was something. It was the one with the guy got the stick in the eye.
Oh, it was zombie, and then was it zombie and demons?
Zombie and demons, and it was it ended with the helicopter landing on the movie
fantastic.
Theater where they were stuck inside, and it was fantastic. So we have had discussions all around this before, but we are all approximately the same age, more or less. And I think David and I have talked about this in the past, that movies like this, it's not that they're hard to find anymore, but it's hard to browse movies of this because they still make, cheap, pandering, gratuitous, fantastic films. But you don't really have the video store aisles to wander the way that you did, back certainly in the 80s. And I think, David, I think it was you that I mentioned that I wanted to do a coffee table book that was just pictures of old video stores and like cheesy, independent video stores from the 80s.
Yeah, no, that would have been, I think I still think that's a great idea. I don't know, but then you and I are those two people that have things are great ideas, and the rest of the world sort of look at us and go, "Yeah, okay, that's a really good idea. Uh-huh, sure." But the 80s era of the mom and pop video stores, and back when you could still rent videos like at the grocery store before the advent of the big like Blockbuster and Hollywood videos, was such an incredible place. And in those early days of home video, a lot of the movies that came out right away, very early on, were the same movies that were playing that now are called grindhouse movies, although in the 80s they just called them either B-movies or exploitation movies. And, these are just the movies that they played at the drive-in, usually, like, towards the tail end of the night. They would do, like, these dusk-to-dawn drive-in specials, and the early part of the evening would be movies for the whole family, and then, towards the end of the night would be like Cannibal Apocalypse or, Night of the Demons, that sort of stuff. And that era really is kind of gone, or it's mutated into something else because there's, home videos dying and drive-ins are dead and those sort of inner city movie theaters. I mean, here in Portland, the Broadway Theater was like that, in its heyday, it was like this huge, beautiful movie theater. But by the 80s, it was, that's where you went to, look for prostitutes and two movies for 99 cents.
Well, the Broadway had like a strip club like connected to it. A lot of old projectionists from the Broadway Theater would go, and there was actually a hole into the dressing room, just totally like Porky's, into the stripper dressing room.
Really?
From the movie theater there. That place is just, yeah, and a lot of the people that worked there were projectionists and stagehands for that would operate the follow spots for the strippers. It was the same.
It's interesting as the drive-ins closed down. It was sort of like and that type of film and the clientele that went with it went from sort of nomadically from one place to another. So the drive-in closes and all that the traffic starts to move to the video store. The video store closes, and I guess it's all. I mean, I'm saying this is impossible to have these conversations without sounding freaking old and like I'm lamenting the good old days or whatever. But again, there's no central point of consolidation. Every town had, David, what you were just talking about was the independent video store. In my hometown in Kennewick, there was this place called Discount Video, which I believe still exists, and it's got the same like crusty ass sign that was up, and it was just like the guy went to like a Prince for Less for like $1.99. He got like a vinyl sign that said Discount Video, and the V I think fell off like immediately. But it was a guy who had a mullet and one eye, and we always heard that he had been in prison at some point. He had gotten out of prison and somehow contrived to open this video store. And I don't know if that's true, but it certainly seems like it was true. And it just had all the hallmarks. This is the sort of thing I could just rhapsodize endlessly in the most florid prose imaginable about how fantastic, trashy video stores were. There was two constants in those video stores. There was the poster that was facing the outside window that then became faded, then yellowed, then bleached, then was just like a curled up piece of paper with nothing on it because the sun just completely leached all of the you know, all of the color and print off of it. And then there was the beaded curtain. And the beaded curtain was what separated the porn films from everything else. And if you were under the age of majority, you would look at that beaded curtain and it just seemed like the most fabulous place you could buy. It seemed like a palace of unimaginable splendor lurked behind it, which was true, by the way, apparently. And the guy would occasionally turn his one eye. That was blind eye. There's a joke there somewhere. But he would, you know, if you would slip him $10, he would sort of let you go back and root around in there, and I think maybe put one inside a killer clown's box or something, you know, so you could rent it. But that vibe is gone, and it's just impossible to rustle up anywhere else. David Walker's calling from inside a train. What is going on in the background there?
It's like on the set of Pelham 123.
Seriously,
I am. I'm. There's a train like a block away, and it's going past. And
all right.
So unfortunately, I'm getting drowned out. I'm waiting. I'm picking my mom up from a doctor appointment, so I'm waiting on her as we're talking.
Well, really, it is a testament to the power and clarity of our connection and of the studio setup we've got here that we heard that train with absolute precision in the background. There was no doubting whatsoever what that noise was.
I thought maybe it was like a cartoon thing, like you were talking about video stores and porn, and it was like in the old Tex Avery cartoons that smoke was just coming out of his ears, and it was like a high-pitched siren.
Or it's my Python dropping.
I will bet to happen, by the way.
So what's like your trailer, like, or not trailer, but like what's your, like, you saw a video box for, like, you were like, damn, that looks so cool.
Frankenhooker.
And totally sucked. It was totally like rusty afterbirth. Watching.
There's two things I will tell you. There's two movies I will tell you because this is. I'm glad you mentioned this. So we're talking with our good friend Siegfried, who is here to talk about Grindhouse trailer
Spectacular
2, which is happening at the Hollywood this Wednesday. And on the phone is David Walker of BadassMofo.com, a film enthusiast in many ways. Don Taylor, of course, at the news desk, who knows. All of you guys know way more about the film than I do. Any one of you, and together it's like it's where the universe just collapses into some sort of filmic singularity.
I have to say, like, David Walker, his magazine of Badass Mofo, that really got me through many years. Him putting that together, that Badass Mofo magazine, that calendar, that really got me actually into the grindhouse kind of world. David Walker.
Oh my God, calendar! So, you're dating yourself right there, man. You got to be careful with that.
I know.
So.
Well, let's do this. Let's go around the room really quickly here, and we'll talk about if you have such a memory, that the movie that jumped out off the shelf at you or something that really caught your attention in a way that movies like really can't do anymore. I will say for me, there's sort of a tie. One is Frankenhooker, and here's why: because the video box for Frankenhooker. It had a blinking light embedded in it. Actually, two of them. If you saw the Frankenhooker VHS box on the shelf, and I sound like a guy lamenting the loss of albums because you can't pick it up and look at the cover art and read the liner notes, but she was a hooker made, I think, of the parts of other hookers that had been stitched together. And it was not like a porn film. It was just like this really, really trashy sort of quasi-horror film. But the gimmick for the box was that the bolts in her neck were, I think, instead earrings, and they would blink. There was a battery in the box, and so you would walk by in the video store, and you're like, Ghoulies, Ghoulies 2, Ghoulies 3, Sorority Babes at the Slimeball Bullarama, Chopper Chicks in Zombie Town. Ooh, what's that? And then you pick up the blinking box, and hey, it's Frankenhooker. This looks fantastic. The second one is a film that I then came to learn was notorious, which is I Spit on Your Grave. And I have to tell you, my friends and I would just go to the video store on a Friday night, and we would rent like 70 movies, like more than we would ever be able to watch. And we'd make it till about 5 in the morning, and then we'd all kind of pass out, and half of them would go back unwatched. I Spit on Your Grave, though, was a movie we rented, and we tried to watch it, I think, 4 different times, and we kept having to turn it off because it was just so freaking disturbing. I mean, it weirded us out so much, but then eventually it became a sort of masculine point of pride, like we had to finish I Spit on Your Grave. And so we went to my friend Sean's house one night, we're like, all right, this is it, gents. This is the weekend we make it through I Spit on Your Grave. You know, anybody who wants to leave must do so now, because there will be no abandoning this quest once it begins. And then we put it in and we watched it, and God damn, what a deeply bizarre... Talking about the movie called Rape Killer, Siegfried was mentioning that. I Spit Killer. On Your Grave is basically just a guy who looks like Gilligan going around and giving a woman what for like the first hour and a half with his friends, after which she cuts off their junk with a boat propeller. The end. So it was a different era. David Walker, what are the quintessential trashy video store movies that you remember?
Mine, the one that I really remember more than any is Toxic Avenger.
Yeah.
Toxic Avenger, which, and, you know, because you're talking about Frankenhooker, and I saw that in the theaters when it came out. And I also remember I worked at a video store when it came out on video, and some of the boxes actually talked. They had those, like, microchip things in there, and if you passed by them, the box would say something. And but I saw Toxic Avenger. I remember going into a video store. It's not there anymore, but it used to be over on Sandy Boulevard, like in the 60s. And they had a cardboard cutout of Toxic Avenger and a sign that said, no one under 18 can rent this movie because it's so violent and nudity and blah, blah, blah. And me and my friends were like, this is the movie we have to rent.
Now we must.
So, watched Toxic Avenger, which really changed my life. It really did. And I'd like to think it changed my life for the better. And again, this was, you know, in that era before the big, huge blockbuster video stores. And there's a couple others. There was a movie called Chain Heat that I saw.
Yeah,
it was Women in Prison with Sybil Danning and Linda Blair.
I was going to say Linda Blair is in that, isn't she?
We've had that.
Yeah.
No, Chained Heat is a fantastic film. I saw that over my my friend Virgil. His dad. I've told the story of Virgil before. His dad was a traveling sales guy and brought home a bunch of porn. But occasionally mixed in with the porn would be sort of this, not even really softcore, but these sex thrillers. Chained Heat, which was it a women's prison like in the South? Was it in Atlanta or something? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't even remember where it was. It was just. There was a lot of naked women in the prison, and that was, like, me, like, at, you know, age 16 or 17, possibly the coolest concept in the world.
Oh, yeah. No, it's fantastic. Dawn Taylor?
Well, I've always been a sucker for, like, human grotesquerie movies. So, like, the first one, I think, again, a life-changing video for me, Basket Case, which is a movie that, not only did I just fall immediately in love with that movie, but I would rent it repeatedly and take it to people's houses inflict it on
subject them to it.
And I love that sort of genre of horror movie. Another one that comes to mind is called Humongous.
Yeah.
With the guy who played Flounder in Animal House.
Yeah,
like, living
Stephen
in,
First.
It, living in the basement and
there's that whole creepy sequence where he has like a teddy bear and he's shoving the teddy bear in the woman's. Why do I remember that?
I'm also browsing the video store introduced me to the Ilsa movies, like Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS, harem keeper leader, whatever. I mean, there's this whole line of Ilsa movies starring, and that is that Sybil Danning too? I can't remember who.
Here's where I am a colossal
David Walker. Who is in the Ilsa movies?
Oh, you know what? I know who made those movies, but I don't know who the stars were. The director was a guy named Don Edmonds. But I don't think any of those actresses were, you know, it wasn't like an actress like Stella Stevens who was down on her luck. I think it was more like she was like some penthouse pet or something like that.
There was somebody named Diane Thorne, apparently. And yeah, she started out as a nude pinup model.
All right, here's what a massive failure I am, actually. That sitting at home, our good friend Keelan sent me a DVD of Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS. And he's like, you got to watch this. It's the best movie I've ever seen in my entire life. And it's been sitting at my house unwatched, low these many weeks. And so apparently I've had just
it's great.
Concentrated gold.
Another great one in the series is Ilsa, Harem Keeper of the Oil Sheiks. And it's shot in like El Segundo, California. And so it's like the oil sheik's palace is actually it's a funeral home. I think it might actually be Forest Lawn. And they shoot some stuff on the front steps, but you can see the big, like, aggregate concrete cigarette things, ashtrays, on either side of the door. And the desert scenes are shot on the beach in El Segundo, and they shoot them down low on the sand by the ocean, so you can see the oil derricks, like, just kind of over the rise of the sand.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, that's an awesome movie.
And then finally, Siegfried, your trashy video store rental.
Grindhouse, I was actually a latecomer for anything exploitative. I mean, I grew up as a Catholic kid, and anything forbidden. I didn't see RoboCop until I was like 9 or 10, and Predator, and kind of got into actual horror till quite later. So, but the one that got me when I was a little kid was seeing the it was my science project, and I was like, that is the coolest video cover ever. And that movie was so lame.
Oh no, that's the thing, is the
so
cover
rotten.
When Dawn mentioned. This is where
the first movie. Oh, I got to tell us the first movie. My dad rented. We bought the VCR. He got the tape, and he goes, "Oh, that looks good." And it was actually Yor from the Future, but it was Yor from the Future. He bought it mostly.
Oh, Yor. Yor. Yeah.
With Red Brown.
Yeah.
But it was Yor from the Future with. But on the cover, it had chicks with. She had six boobs. She was kind of like. And so.
I think this will be three times better than the last movie I
and
saw.
And there was no lady with six boobs in the movie. It was just on the poster.
It's funny, when Dawn mentioned Basket Case just now, it's probably been 15 or 20 years since I've been, wandered the aisles of a video store that way, and certainly, but I can picture the cover for Basket Case just like it was yesterday. It's just a little sliver of light on an actual wicker basket with a pair of eyes looking out, and then it says Basket Case in a blood font, like the Cannibal Corpse logo or something. And the thing with the video, with the VHS cover in the video store, is that was not unlike in the 80s when you would look at the video game cover for your Atari 2600 game. And it would look like the most action-packed, thrilling, adventure-laden game you could possibly and then you buy it, and it's just like one cube moving around the screen, bumping into another cube occasionally, and then the screen flickers, and then the game is over. And it goes, and then that's the end. You go, oh, crap. But that is a quintessentially American experience, learning the difference between what you are promised by the advertisement or the front of the box and knowing what that hamburger actually looks like once you open it up. So,
but
awesome.
I mean,
that's kind of what dating is like, yeah.
See, nowadays, I think everybody's gotten kind of become numb from YouTube, and we can see anything anytime, and now we don't have video boxes to look at. Even trailers suck now. It's like they show the whole movie. There's no cool teasers. I mean, the last cool teaser I saw was Tron. I was like, that was actually a good teaser. But nowadays it's dreadful. That's why it's I love the Grindhouse trailers, because it really catches your eye.
And I cannot say this strongly enough. It's happening this Wednesday at the Hollywood Theater at
7:30. 7:30 at the kind of a dump of the Hollywood Theater, but it's a cool dump.
No, it's I love that place. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the Hollywood Theater. 7:30, Grindhouse, Trailer Spectacular 2. And I cannot endorse this strongly enough. If you have never seen one of these sort of big conglomerations of trailers, I don't know how much it costs to get in, but it doesn't matter. It's worth it. Whatever the ticket is, you should pay double that just to thank them for putting this
and
on.
And honestly, most of the time, the trailers are far more entertaining than the movies themselves. And so now you get just to see a huge pile of trailers.
I'm going to say 99% of the time, the trailer is more entertaining than the actual movie itself.
In fact, the proof of that, the last time that you guys did this, when the first Grindhouse Trailer Spectacular happened, one of them was for the Toolbox Murders, which I had always seen on the shelf as a kid, but I'd never actually rented it. And so I went and I found Toolbox Murders, and I was like, well, I guess it's time. And the trailer, of course, as Dawn just said, as David was alluded to, makes it look fantastic. It's the best movie ever made. This must rival Lawrence of Arabia. I got to go. And I went out and I got it, and I took it home. First of all, there's no toolbox ever. There's a tool. There's a guy who has like a hammer, I think, at one point. There is no toolbox. And there is, in fact, I think, one murder. So there's tool murder. That's it. No box and no plural. The only thing remotely interesting about Toolbox Murders, spoiler alert, is that the killer is Wesley from Land of the Lost. And that's it. That is the extent of it. But the trailer is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right. Excellent. David Walker, what is happening at badassmofo.com and in your life in general that people need to know about?
Well, we're talking about Grindhouse and exploitation and all that stuff. I'm now involved in a web series called Missing Reel, And it is a web series where what we do is we take a look back at some of the greatest exploitation and grindhouse films of all time. The pilot episode just went live, I think, yesterday or the day before. I'm working with Kurt Lloyd on this show. And so our first episode, we take a look back on the ever-popular rape revenge genre, subgenre, and one of the movies we look at is I Spit on Your Grave.
Awesome.
Which, like you, I can't tell you how many times it took me to get through that movie. I mean, the box was always so enticing with, you know, the half-naked woman, and then you watch the movie and you're like, oh my God,
yeah.
I'm 14 and I feel like I'm doing something that I'm going to go to hell for. So that's like actually the big news in my life right now.
Absolutely.
And other than that, just my schedule's crazy. Otherwise, I would be in there today. We could be talking about this live face-to-face. But, Missing Reel, and you can just go to the website is Missing Reel, and Reel is spelled R-E-E-L.tv. We've got a fan page on Facebook, and you can watch the pilot episode. It's only like 12 minutes long. It's up on YouTube right now.
Fantastic.
So you'll learn a little something about... you'll probably learn more about I Spit on Your Grave than you ever wanted to know. And a couple other movies. I won't tell you what the other ones are until you watch it.
Really? I got to tell you, you're talking to a guy. I watched 2 hours worth of documentary footage on Creepshow last weekend. So, I mean, really, this is right in my wheelhouse. Excellent. David Walker, the website is badassmofo.com or the David Walker site. .com. I'll let you get back to your train and your mom and whatnot. So
she's just getting out of the doctor appointment, but you know that's just part of the love of all of this is that you know I love you so much I'll call you from a parking lot where there's a train whizzing by. So
excellent. Well, we're giving you.
I will. Hopefully, I'll see you Wednesday night at the trailer show.
Absolutely, without a doubt. There you go. Thank you, my friend. There you go. That's David Walker, ladies and gentlemen. Awesome. All right. My final note about all this is somebody was mentioning that inflicting a movie on somebody. Don, you said you inflicted Basket Case on people.
Oh yes. And most of the time, like-minded friends, they would love it. Other times, you know, there would be people who would just sit there. And I'm sure you've had that experience where they look at you and they just go,
what have you brought into my home?
What's wrong with you?
Why
would you do this?
See, I bring people like Hanzo. I like, dude, you got to watch Hanzo. He's totally cool. And then Ichi the Killer, I've brought in many a times. That's ruined many a friendship. But it's also, you know, that one is a full-on tilt of
movie. Most recently for me, I think it was Old Boy, where I was like, you've got to see this. This movie is brilliant, and didn't really warn them ahead of time of what they were in
for. I
watched that at Siegfried's urging. He was like,
you
got to watch this movie, Old Boy. And I think you said if you can make it through the squid sequence, you can make it through anything.
That's
a disturbing film.
But it's a brilliant movie, though.
There's no violence.
There's no violence in it. It's all mental.
Well, except for the hammer scene in the...
Except
for the bludgeoning.
There's actually
hammer.
No, it's all like you. You see the hammer go and everything like that. But there's really, and then you see the guy cutting off the tongue.
But there's no violence.
No. But you don't. No, you don't actually see the cut. You don't.
It's implied. It's very
implied,
much.
But it's the most emotionally like.
It's
like,
a draining experience.
Yeah. It's like Seven. You know, it's like very much where Seven had more gore, of course. You know. This was like that emotional, your trauma that you're watching the movie.
Old Boy is a fantastic film. Yeah. I strongly recommend that.
That and Sympathy of Lady Vengeance was this movie Park did right after it, and that's fantastic too. It takes about 20 minutes to get into it, but it's fantastic. She's a lady who's she goes to prison for a murder she didn't do, and she goes out for vengeance, and she makes her own gun. It's totally cool.
Awesome.
And it's like the most artistic gun, and she's just like, but it's like Old Boy. Yeah. It's really traumatizing.
Yeah, it's part of like this sort of trilogy he did with Mr. Vengeance and
Don't See Mr. Vengeance.
And Mr. Vengeance is not very good. Yeah.
No, it's lame. And then don't watch those other ones. His vampire one, lame. Thirst, that didn't work out. And then his other one, what was it? I forgot what the name is, but the one in that, like, it was kind of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but it sucked. But Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, top of probably my decade, like, of the past 10 years, like, one of the best. Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, and especially Old Boy. Old Boy was just spectacular.
Excellent.
I just love that movie.
The Grindhouse Trailer Spectacular 2 happens this Wednesday at the Hollywood Theater at 7 o'clock. And so you can find out more. I think it's, I forget if it's hollywoodtheater.org or something. Just go type in Hollywood Theater Portland and it'll come up.
I don't mean to wax your car, but this is the coolest radio show ever that we can talk about rape violence films. Like,
in a sort of theoretical
way. That's what makes it cool.
That's
really, I mean, like, I can't believe... Wow, it's pretty bizarre. But
yes,
that's
going to go into our sales material right now. No, it's nothing but rape killing all the time. Could we have your money, please? Maybe I won't put this on. I'm putting together this sort of sampler because you all out there, you're listening to the show and you sort of know the the concentrated genius that is the Rick Emerson program. But I'm putting together a little bit of a trailer, sort of a 20-minute sampler of the show. Now that we've been on for a few weeks, and I'm going to put over, Legion of News, on the site, so people who say, "Where is my 32 cents today? What for? What what am I going to get for that money? What entertainment forms will be given to me?" I will probably lead with this, just you saying "rape killer" over and over and over again, and then going "awesome." All right. Anyway, so go see that this Wednesday. Siegfried, I think you will have to come back and join us again in the near future.
Yes.
My name is Rick Emerson. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Still to come, Don Taylor at the news desk. We have a penis watch on the way. Britney watch. Today's top five misinterpreted rock songs. That is all coming up. And, of course, more of your phone calls at 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Stay there. The Rick Emerson Show continues next.
If you had one shot to sit on your lazy butt and watch all the TV you ever wanted until your brain turned to mush, would you go for it or just let it slip?
Yo. Remote is ready. Eyes wide, palms are sweaty. The Flintstones on the TV already. Wilma and Betty. No virgin. The channel surfing and I'm HD ready. So I flip. Garbage is all I'm getting. The Simon Cowell who folks want to disembowel. He opens his mouth, always says something foul. They're dying, wow. Wannabes are crying now. He votes them out. Time to throw in the towel. Shows based on reality. Oh, the humanity. Oh, Aussie's family show. Love profanity. Whoa, the insanity. Oh, dogs that crap and pee. Home of depravity. No, they live happily. Yo, plus the Ally G show and celebrity mole. Oh, and there's Anna Nicole. She's scaring me. Look, mono cavities. Oh, it's a station break. Better go out to the kitchen and microwave something.
You're gonna lose your mind watching TV. They told me, they told me, but I still tune in every show. My cable gets C-SPAN TV Land and HBO. The Travel Channel Discovery and Lifetime.
You're gonna
lose your mind watching TV. They told me, cajoled me, turn off those music videos. I'm gonna watch C-SPAN TV Land and HBO. The History Channel and QVC and Lifetime.
My butt is aching as I watch NASCAR racing. That show about undertaking Larry King to 24 to Line Order. The Weather Channel's boring, like 60 Minutes, Ancient Reporters. Next up on E! True Hollywood Story, the rise and decline of 12 actors named Corey. Shows for next fall, they already been naming. CSI Boise and Touched by an Uncle both sound pretty lame. And so does everybody tolerates Raymond. And King of Queens jumped the shark the first minute. I can't believe. Right under 8 simple rules for dating my teenage daughter. Then I bet I watch The Bachelorette, followed by Welcome Back, Carter, and The Muppet Show, where they go Manama.
You're gonna lose your mind watching TV. They told me, they told me, but I still tune in every show. My cable gets C-SPAN TV Land and HBO, the Disney Channel and A&E and Lifetime.
You're gonna
lose your mind watching TV. They told me, cajoled me, but I still love Lisa Kudrow. I'm looking at C-SPAN TV The Playboy Channel and Court TV and Lifetime.
Never missed Melrose Place or Lost in Space. I've seen each amazing race and without a trace. But I only watched Will and Grace one time, one day. Wish I hadn't, cause TiVo now thinks I'm gay. Oh, and Fear Factor, I watched maybe a half hour. After that, felt like I needed a long shower. Network execs with naked ambitions. Next week on Fox, watch Lions Eat Christians. Like to tie up those programming planners. Make them watch all of that junk till their heads explode just like scanners. Leech covered grub-eating fools on Survivor. Look, there's James Lipton discussing the oeuvre of Mr. Rob Schneider. And there's Gilligan and SpongeBob Plus. There's MacGyver and Jay Leno has got Madonna. Hey, there's Luke Perry on a special all-pig Latin episode of Drew Carey. Wanna turn on E.T.? Cause I'm a gossip freak. And I gotta know who J-Lo is marrying this week. A 30-second spot, then we come back to Are You Hot? I was planning on recording The Sopranos. I forgot. I love shows with or without a plot.
stare till my legs are numb, my eyes bloodshot, because I only have got one brain to rot. I'm going to spend my life watching television a lot. You're gonna lose your mind watching TV.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It is Monday, July 5th, 2010. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com or chat live at rickemerson.com, the website. In mere moments, we go back to the news desk with Don Taylor. Coming up, we have a penis watch. Also, top five on the way. We have the top five misinterpreted rock songs of all time. That is on the way. And I had something to say that it seemed like it was massively important, and now I can't remember what it was. I'm going to give myself like 4 seconds to try to come up with it. No, I have.
This wasn't this thing about my sexual leanings, was it?
No, although I have made a note to myself to get into that tomorrow. Oh, you know, speaking of sexual leanings, let me just say this, that I can now conflate that topic with what we were just discussing with Siegfried and David Walker, who, by the way, let me just take a moment to acknowledge what an utterly fantastic conversation that was that we had in the last segment, which is, and it's not like I'm just, Siegfried said this and it's about me, so it's hard for me to agree with it because then it looks like I'm just talking about how awesome the show is, which it is, have no doubt. But that is a shared collective cultural experience. I mean, as much as it seems like it's a thing that is not that important or worthy of conversation, imagine how many hours of your life you've spent wandering some dusty-ass video store looking at some movie like Voltage 5000, I think it was called, which had Lyle Alzado from the Oakland Raiders, who I think went around enforcing justice with like a massive spark plug gun that he shot people with. I mean, it was just they really were the best of times.
And I could sit down for like hours and talk about this with these two guys.
Oh, yeah.
It's just... amazing.
You talked about inflicting the movie Basket Case on people. I have a friend of mine who used to do that with the movie Bloodsucking Freaks.
Oh, yeah.
Which, by the way, ends with a guy who looks just like Jim Carrey having his blood sucked out of his brain with a straw. And when I was living, I'm only telling that so I can tell you this, that when I was living in Utah, when I was a young and not really swinging single guy, but I endeavored to swing. It didn't really come together for me. Sort of just a vibrating. But when I was sort of out on the dating scene, I remember meeting a young lady, and who at one point she decided that the evening should move back to her place, and so there I am. How do I tell this story?
Tell it as graphically as possible. I want details.
I was at the home of this young woman in Salt Lake who had foolishly, she'd been swindled into thinking I was somehow attractive for a couple hours. I don't know how that worked. But we were on her couch and...
You're making out?
Sure. Let me put it this way. We were at the stage between making out and full-on sexing.
I believe that's called foreplay.
Sure.
That's what they call it in the books.
I never know what second base, third base, I don't know any of this. I was free to watch television, let's put it that way. And I wasn't really doing anything. I was just sort of reclined.
That's past foreplay. That's actual full-on sex.
Five play. Yeah. Well, it's a form of sex.
Bill Clinton would differ.
There we go. That is happening. But I'm on the couch, and she didn't have any roommates. It was just her. You know, it was just the two of us there. Nobody else there. So I have to assume that this came from her. On the television, I realize as this act is taking place, is the movie Bloodsucking Freaks. Which is just the weirdest thing to watch, like under normal circumstances. But I mean, you're there and you're just enjoying this act of intimacy, and in the background, there's a guy going and getting blood sucked out of his brain. And I think there's a castration scene actually that happens not too long afterward. I think there's some sequence where a guy's junk gets taken off, and I swear to God, like put in a hot dog bun.
So did this affect your enjoyment of what was going on, either negatively or positively?
No. Men have the ability to sort of partition. It's like having a hard drive that is half Mac, half Windows, or where you can partition off like a Linux section.
It was just that there was this thing going on, which was awesome, and then, oh, and look over there. That's awesome, too.
Yeah. And in fact, but then the totality of the, the confluence of the two, in fact, made for, it was really more than the sum of its parts that whole night. All right, well, in any event, at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
I don't know why I decided to tell that story. Here's Dawn Taylor.
I'm glad you did. Yeah. A family in India kidnapped a male relative and kept him in a coffin for over 2.5 years after he refused to give them his bungalow. Rajan Kilikar, 41, a biotechnology scientist, was rescued Saturday after police in Western India were alerted to the kidnapping by an anonymous letter, as reported by the Indian Express. Investigating officer Jaydeep Singh Sarvia, I'll say it very slowly and still mispronounce it, said that the letter told him that a local property dealer named Hitesh Karavadra killed Kelliker to stake claim over his property. Police raided Mr. Karavadra's house and found Mr. Kelliker in a 6-foot by 3-foot coffin. The victim said he had been confined there since December 2007 after Mr. Karavadra had hit him on the head with a baseball bat and stolen the keys to his house.
So this was because they wanted a bungalow, and I'm unclear about what a bungalow even is, by the way. I don't know if that's like a cottage.
It's a tiny little house.
Or a villa.
It's a small little house, like a cottage.
Okay. So they wanted the bungalow. He said no. And so they just kept him for a year thinking that he would eventually, what, either die or sign the property over?
For 2.5 years. And they did let him out of the coffin once a day for a meal.
Well, that was nice of them.
And I'm hoping to use the bathroom.
Mr.
Kilikar, who is unmarried, was rarely in touch with his family, which consists of a brother and 3 married sisters. He apparently rarely spoke to them, just once in a year or two. Mr. Kilikar later lodged a case of abduction and other charges against Karavadar, his wife, mother, and accomplices.
How was it that? How did they discover that he was in the coffin?
An anonymous letter.
Okay, so somebody. It seems like there's a finite number of people who knew about this, by the way, unless they were just sort of bringing folks over just to show him off. Look, a guy in a coffin at home.
Well, unfortunately, it seems like there were a lot of people that knew about this. There was the guy, there was his wife, there was his mother, and 1, 2, 3, 4 accomplices. 4 other people knew about it. So that's an awful lot of people to keep a secret like that.
Living in a coffin for a year sounds like a bad way to spend that
time.
2.5 years. 2.5 years?
Yes. Since December of 2007.
Well, there's like at a certain point, I would think you would just be full on screaming nuts, like after the first month or so.
I would think so, too.
All right. Well, that's a disturbing story. Thank you, Dawn.
You're welcome.
This is Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
We have a penis watch.
Do we ever? Here's your penis watch for Monday, July 5th, 2010, on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Take a look at my enormous penis. Saying my troubles start a melting away. Bow, bow, bow. I take a look at my enormous penis. Saying everything is going my way.
Bow, bow, bow. Here is Dawn Taylor with your penis watch.
Hospitals in Jamaica are reporting a rise in the number of fractured genitals caused by rough sex in a wave of so-called daggering that is causing damage across the island nation. According to the Jamaica Star, there's been a sharp rise in the number of men who are stumbling into the ER with broken penises.
No.
We've noticed an increase, a urologist from Kingston Public Hospital, who said he was treating up to 2 cases a month. Almost every other week since late last year, there is 1 case for this hospital, he said. So here's what they think is happening.
Yes.
Well, I'll read it the way it says in the story.
All right, hold on a second. Let's give everybody just a second to brace themselves. All right.
This is by way of explaining what daggering is.
All right, I think.
Men like porn. Men like sex. Men decide to hit it like the porn stars do and give in to a little rough loving, but a man has bad aim and ends up fracturing his penis.
Here's the thing. I know that women have the pain of childbirth and that, that is an uncomfortable thing, as we talked about this with Ryan White last week, it's the worst pain that a woman can possibly endure and so forth. But here's the thing is... It's not that I'm unsympathetic, but I'm saying that's a thing you opt to do. That's pretty much appointment pain. I mean, there are many, many, many chances to take an off-ramp from that highway. Nobody forces you to have a baby in most cases. So that's different because that – and you have months to anticipate that. That's the other thing. The pain of childbirth, however agonizing it may be to shove a child out of that thing – you got 9 months to think like, okay, well, look, this is going to be. And then they teach you breathing techniques, and they, you know, you can get drugs. And, you know, and plus there's the miracle of, you know, of childbirth that is part of it. And some women, I think probably I've been told, you know, I've heard tell that there are women who sort of strangely enjoy the pain because they, you know, because it's so tied in with motherhood and new life and whatever. This is a thing. You get no warning. And not only that, here's the other reason this is not like childbirth and why this is way worse than the pain of childbirth. The I can't even say it out loud. The fractured penis. It's just you're just saying the phrase. It causes me the agita. The other reason this is not like childbirth pain is because in childbirth pain, it's like a gradual sort of, you know, well, I'm bloated and I'm waddly and, oh, my water's broken. Ah, it's uncomfortable. Now it hurts a lot. Oh, my God, it hurts a ton. You know, like you're building up toward it. And I guess you can make the point that the pain lasts longer, but it's a gradually. This is like the most hairpin turn from, wow, this is awesome, to, wow, I wish I was dead.
Yeah.
This is the worst thing. And there's no... I don't believe there is any female equivalent to this, by the way, in terms of the sexing.
I don't think there is. No.
Even in like the, even if you're if you are a woman who has never known the touch of a man and you are having intercourse for the first time, right. I'm assuming that doesn't feel swell all the time. But it seems like this is probably a different world.
I mean, pain. There are mishaps that can happen that are extremely unpleasant for the female partner.
I can
but
only
nothing
think of
like this. Nothing, nothing getting broken.
I can only think of one. Mishap that can happen for the woman.
Yeah, and that's a bad one.
Wait, no, I wonder if we're talking about the same thing. Hold on a second.
I think we are.
No, this is just but see, now I have to know. I hope people appreciate that Rick Emerson Show does not traffic in coarse language or blue dialogue. Are you talking about when you say the one mishap that can happen you know, during sex for women? Are you talking about where it's like here? No. It's like this. Are you talking about like in Levittown years ago, where guys would get really drunk, and they would come home from come home on the 509 or whatever, maybe after having a few belts at the bar, Don Draper style, and you know, it would be nighttime, and so at night a lot of the houses look the same. And so he
pulls his car into the wrong driveway.
Yeah, they thought they were putting the key into the lock of their own home, but really it was the house right next door.
Yeah, that
in the dark, yes. You could confuse, and then the person inside says, "Wrong house."
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yes.
All right, okay. Why is this happening in Jamaica, though? I mean, as opposed to elsewhere.
Apparently, in Jamaica, there's been a rash of guys deciding that they want to be more forceful in the bedroom. I'm not sure. And particularly since there apparently is a phrase for it. They call it daggering.
But it's it sounds like it's not even really rough sex so much as it is...
stabby sex.
sort of rapid sex.
Yes, there we
go. This is sort of a jackhammering, pummeling kind of sex.
Oh, yeah, that's way better than me saying stabby. You wince when I say stabby, and then you say jackhammering.
Well,
that's way better.
Stabby makes it sound like it's some sort of like there's some sort of violence happening or something. Where
well,
this is
I'm
just,
I'm
sort
just
of
trying
a,
to think because it's got to be there's a specific action that would cause you to be in the position where you could, you know, fracture.
Well,
it's like, you know, there is pummeling correctly. And then there is apparently pummeling incorrectly, then making it more stabby, which is how you would fracture.
Now, see, but here's the
penis.
Thing. Just speaking as a man, I think that the deal here, this is the most awkward conversation, and yet we just continue to have it. I think that what they're talking about there is a, let's see, what is the proper analogy here? It's, okay, let me put it this way. If the car is in the garage in Levittown, mm-hmm. Let's say you've even gone into the right house in the right garage, the right car in the right garage in Levittown, and you're real OCD, and so you want the car to be, you know, you want the car to be straightened in there properly. So you back up and then you pull forward a little bit, and then you go, that's not quite right. You back up, and you don't have one of those little tennis balls that hangs down to tell you when you're in correctly. You back up, pull forward, back up. You're probably not, you know, your risk of having an accident there is relatively minor.
Right.
If, however, you decide that the best way to get the car into the garage correctly is to roar backward at 70 miles an hour.
All the way out of the garage.
Also across the street, and then roar back into the garage, and then do it 100 times in a row, the odds are eventually you're going to miss the garage and you're going to hit the wall on the way in.
I believe that's exactly what's happening.
So I think it's a matter of velocity. That's what we're talking about here in terms of this totally horrific story that I regret hearing with every bone in my body.
Well, according to the story, I like that it says, how do you know if you've fractured your penis? I don't think there's really any question, but it does point that if you it will hurt like nothing you've ever felt before. Yeah. You will hear a pop at the initial contact.
Ah, okay.
And then it will start to swell or bruise.
Okay.
So, and you should, by the way, if this happens to you, you should immediately get medical attention because if left untreated, a fractured penis can cause impotence or deformation.
So,
don't do the daggering, and B, if something happens, go to a hospital.
And with that, we will bring the curtain down on another...
Take a look at my enormous penis.
Wow.
And my troubles start
a it's been a long time since I had to get up and walk across the studio, which does negligible good because then you realize you're wearing headphones.
You're still listening.
The story's going with me as I travel. Jesus God Almighty. All right. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program at the news desk. This is Dawn Taylor.
Oh, are we going to do the top five,
Let's
or do you want
to
do another
one more here, and then we will roll on into the top five.
All right.
Good God.
A British man has admitted threatening to kill two police officers with a nail gun during a 13-hour standoff at a construction yard in Orkney.
Is a nail gun now one of your Google News alerts?
Yes,
be honest.
It is.
Awesome. Fantastic.
Yes, it is.
What else? What other news alerts have you added to Google since you began doing this program?
Added Voice of God, taser, penis, all this. What
Wait,
else?
Voice of God, is that as in... the man said he fed his family into a wood chipper after hearing the voice
exactly.
of God. Okay.
And speaking of which, wood chipper is another one
God
of
bless
my,
you, Dawn Taylor.
My Google alerts.
That's fantastic.
So, because I have to collect the important news.
The people
the
have
Rick
to
Emerson
be served.
Show.
You know.
And by the way, I did come up with a new wood chipper story, so we'll have one for tomorrow.
We'll do that tomorrow. We got to get a wood chipper watch. All right, here's Dawn Taylor.
Kirkwall Sheriff Court heard 50-year-old builder Lawrence Leonard's concerned family had contacted police early on Saturday. They had discovered a letter in which he made reference to, quote, going out in a blaze of glory. Firearms officers and negotiators were brought in before he gave himself up. It later emerged that he had no nail gun. So he was threatening to kill officers with a nail gun, yet he had no nail gun.
From where did the threat emerge?
He threatened to kill two police officers with a nail gun.
But I mean online or to friends
no,
at a bar?
No, during a 13-hour standoff.
Oh, I see. He was already holed up somewhere.
He's 50 years old, and I'm thinking maybe a
Crazy.
Little unhinged to begin with. His family found a letter in which he made reference to going out in a blaze of glory. They called, I guess, the police, and there was some kind of standoff, and
he said, I got a nail gun in here.
Yeah.
And then, and now is he dead? Did the police...
No. They apparently, they brought a... He gave himself up after 13 hours, and apparently had no nail gun.
Well, and the nail gun isn't really going to do what you want it to do anyway. It's, I mean, unless you've really got a high-quality nail gun that...
Well, I'm thinking, if you're going to make up having a weapon, why don't you say you have an actual gun?
Yeah.
Why would you say, I've got a nail gun?
Or something that, something that might actually do. You could say you got a bazooka or something. Because if you said he had a missile launcher.
A flamethrower. Something really impressive. Yeah, hand grenades.
And like in 2010, it's outside of the realm of possibility that you would have one of those things.
I wonder if he was just trying to think logically, saying, well, I'm in, Great Britain, and it's more difficult to get firearms here, so they might not believe I have a gun. What believably might I have? Nail gun.
What obtainable weapon could I have?
Right.
Yeah, because unless you're John Carmack, that nail gun isn't really going to do a whole lot of good.
I suppose his family could have just said, he doesn't have a gun. We know he doesn't have one.
Fantastic. Speaking of, have you ever seen the movie Nail Gun Massacre?
No.
Oh, man. After the Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
I didn't know that actually existed.
Oh, no. Of course. After the we were talking about Grindhouse movies earlier. After the Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out, there was a whole series of... there was, Slumber Party Massacre, Slumber Party Massacre 2 and 3, Nail Gun Massacre. I believe...
I'm making a note of that right now.
Oh, Nail Gun Massacre is terrible. There was something else... It was like Power Drill Massacre or something. I mean, it's like the names just got less and less and less imaginative. So
Caulking Gun Massacre.
It really became actively ludicrous, like almost immediately. All right. Without further ado, ladies and gentlefolk, here is your top five for Monday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy, I love to count, don't you?
And indeed it is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. This is your top five, courtesy of Don Taylor. Don Taylor, what was the inspiration for this top five?
I was sitting in the living room across from my husband and saying, for the love of God, help me. I need to come up with a top five.
Got to have something, and I have nothing.
And he came up with something. I can't remember what it was, and I didn't like it. And then I said, or we could do top five misinterpreted rock songs.
So really this came from the relative paucity of ideas that Patrick was able to come up with.
And myself, really. All right. It was...
Yeah. All right. These are the top five misinterpreted rock songs as compiled by Ms. Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Number five. Oh, actually, we start with the honorable mention, don't we? Honorable mention, Freedom of Choice, Devo.
And this is right there. All right. Now, you'll have to walk. I have my Devo knowledge is not it's so low it doesn't even register on the scale. So you'll have to tell me.
Well, this is a song like a lot of Devo songs. It's been picked up and used for commercial purposes. This was used in a 2003 commercial for Miller Lite beer with people toppling each other over like a giant line of dominoes. And then Mark Mothersbaugh said of that one that he actually liked this one as much as the Swiffer commercial. Using a Devo song gives me goosebumps of repulsion.
The Swiffer commercial, is that the Swiff It Good?
Yes.
Thing? Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of people believe that this song is about exactly what, you know, freedom of choice. How great it is to be an American and have freedom of choice, ignoring the last chorus that goes, "Freedom of choice is what you've got. Freedom from choice is what you want."
Ah.
So it's actually not a song celebrating personal freedom at all. It's a commentary on people want their choices made for them.
This is like how every idiot couple at a wedding reception wanted me to play I Will Always Love You, which I think is about a dead guy, or about people who are breaking up, at least. I mean, it's a relationship gone awry. People don't really think these things through.
Yeah, Jerry Casale said that the song is about how people were throwing away their freedom of choice on meaningless choices like between Pepsi or Coke, or pink fur shoes or blue suede shoes. It's just mindless consumerism. They'd rather not be free. They'd rather be told what to do.
The best part is how Mark Mothersbaugh and presumably the other guys in Devo as well, he just makes a ton of money every year creating music for commercials and for mindless consumerism, which I applaud. Well done, sir. I think I read an interview with Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo one time where he said that he started putting backward messages into a lot of his commercials. And whenever he had to advertise something to children, he would start putting these messages in background about vote Democrat. don't eat sugar. These are the top five misinterpreted rock songs, according to Dawn Taylor.
Number five, Mirror in the Bathroom, the English Beat. Now, of course, the 80s, so people naturally assumed this was a song about someone in the bathroom doing coke off a mirror.
That's immediately what I thought.
Yeah. Dave Wakeling, the lead singer of the English Beat, says that he was working in construction at the time, and it was the middle of winter. And he went into the bathroom to shave. It was snowing outside. He really didn't want to go to work. So he started talking to himself in the mirror, and he says, it was weird because I looked deeper in the mirror, and I could see the little caption on the door behind, and I said to myself, look, David, there's just me and you in here. The door is locked. We don't have to go to work. And that's how he started thinking about the song. It's a song about how self-involvement turns into narcissism, and narcissism turns into isolation.
I think the cocaine thing is much more interesting. I sometimes wish that I didn't know the story. Why are you ruining everything, Dawn Taylor? You're just... Destroying all of my own interpretations. This is a song that I used to hear all the time because I had a roommate who listened to, it's an English Beat fanatic, and just listened to, it was like some greatest hits or some box set, and it just like cycled over and over and over again for what seemed like weeks and weeks and weeks on end.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite bands back in the day.
God, there's no song that can't be ruined by a saxophone.
Oh, the saxophone, I love saxophones.
You don't.
And I loved ska. Oh my God, I loved ska.
Maybe you are my roommate. All he listened to, seriously, this notwithstanding, the vast majority of his record collection was, he listened to two things primarily. Probably 90% of the music that came out of his room was either Rush or ska.
Because I don't see how those two things go together.
He had been
all.
A Rush fan growing up. It was sort of the inverse of how these things often happen, where you grow up with whatever music taste, and then you hear rock and roll, and it changes or whatever. He'd grown up as a Rush fan, and then he was exposed to ska, you know. Maybe he lost a bet or something. So he became a huge ska fan. But he grandfathered in Rush as like a holdover from his rock and roll days. So it would just be like I would be sitting there just trying to sleep or just trying to concentrate or just wondering what the hell I was doing with my stupid, miserable, failed life. And through the wall would either be, I would either hear like, you know, a Rush song coming through like a Closer to the Heart kind of a thing. Or I would just hear Mustard Plug, you know, or like the Scottalites or something. Just, it was just the worst time ever. All right, this, we have to be done with this now. Yes. There we go. These are the top five misinterpreted rock songs according to Dawn Taylor.
Number four, Comfortably Numb, Pink Floyd.
Now, wait, I should tell you, to go on, I should actually now try to guess exactly what the song is about or what I believe the song to be about, and then you can just disabuse me of that notion.
I just assumed you knew the actual background of this song.
Well, I just figured it was drugs. Isn't everything really just about drugs? The Mirror song notwithstanding.
People do commonly think that this song is about drugs.
I have nothing.
Roger Waters claims that it's actually about what he felt like as a child when he was sick with a fever. And as an adult, he got that feeling again sometimes, entering a state of delirium where he felt detached from reality. In a radio interview around 1980 with Jim Ladd on KOLS in L.A., Waters said that part of the song was also about the time he got hepatitis, but he didn't know it. Pink Floyd had to do a show that night in Philadelphia, and the doctor Roger saw gave him a sedative to help with the pain, thinking that he had a stomach disorder. And at the show, his hands were numb, like two tiny toy balloons. He was unable to focus, but he also realized the fans didn't care because they were so busy screaming. So he was comfortably numb.
You know, it's so like Roger Waters, as he's telling a fairly interesting story about hepatitis, to then put in the obligatory F my fans. I mean, just, I get the feeling that when that guy goes out just to get the mail in the morning or something, he just goes down to buy a brick of cheese. You know, that on the way, I hate my fans! Jesus. I don't want to think that Pink Floyd's singing about hepatitis. That's not, that just seems wrong somehow. We'd like to sing a song now about botulism. Sing along, won't you, please? I mean, that's, I don't wish to, I wish I hadn't known that. I don't like these things you're putting in my head today.
I'm sorry.
Boy, what a great song this is, though. You want to talk about, I'm just saying for me, now in the opinion of Rick Emerson, this song contains, primarily the second one, but this song contains the greatest guitar solo ever recorded by any human ever. Like in the history of recorded art. There's no guitar solo. I mean, the first one is fantastic. The second one, I think, even better. But if you view these two solos as one, in other words, if you view this as one ongoing sort of guitar solo of this song, this is the greatest guitar solo ever recorded.
I've spent years loathing Pink Floyd because I worked with a guy.
How is that possible?
Well, I worked in a restaurant kitchen, and we would get turns at the tape player
right.
every day.
And that's just a way that leads to hate.
Yeah, and one of my coworkers, he only would play two things. He would play Pink Floyd, or he would play Blue Oyster Cult.
So it's funny, you had a variation on my only ska or Rush roommate. Yeah.
And so for years, I just loathed Pink Floyd. But I love this song. And I have this feeling now, grudgingly, that if I actually gave Pink Floyd a chance, I would probably really, really like them. But I just hated them in this knee-jerk sort of way, because I was forced to listen to The Wall over and over and over again.
And I will say, it surprises me that you're... I mean, I guess it doesn't surprise me knowing the reason why or the context for this, but just in general, objectively speaking, I guess I sort of assumed that everyone on Earth is a Pink Floyd fan. In fact, the only person I know other than you, and now I know that at least you have a reason for it, Sarah had this ex-boyfriend. Sarah dated this guy for a long time who just despised Pink Floyd. And I always got the sense it was a little bit of a, like it was a kind of a front. Like it was a little bit of a, it was kind of a pose. Because he didn't really seem to know, like he'd never really been exposed to Pink Floyd, I don't think. But he, up until this revelation minutes ago, he was actually the only person I have ever met that actively disliked Pink Floyd. Because it sort of seems like now when you're born, they imprint it right on one of your genes, you know? Just one of the greatest songs ever recorded, though, is this. I mean, it's... I hate to... You know, it's,
and you now start, you know it's about...
hepatitis.
Him being a kid and having a 105-degree fever with hepatitis.
See, and then you run the risk of sounding... You run the risk of sounding like Matt Dillon in Singles, where you talk about, you know, where is the Iron Man? Where is the Misty Mountain Hop of our generation? But this really is just a singular song. I mean, there is, in my opinion, there is no other song that is quite like this. I mean, there's nothing to which this song can be compared. I'm just killing time here, because now we have to hear at least part of this guitar solo.
Oh, okay.
See, and he does that, and he... There's the little, like, the little feedback that drops into it there. This is why I don't need to do drugs, because if I was high, I think this song would be so impossibly great, I wouldn't even be able to breathe.
This really is a beautiful, beautiful guitar solo.
It leaves me speechless. There's very few things that will do that. Here's the thing. The thing about this guitar solo is it's so unbelievably unbelievable. I know this sounds like some sort of philosophical nattering, but it is hard to imagine that there was a time, like there was a day when this guitar solo didn't exist, and then David Gilmour just walked in and plugged in a guitar and said, well then, let me knock something out. And then he just recorded this. I mean, that a guy sat in a studio.
And the other guy sat around, yeah, that'll do.
All right,
that'll
then.
Be okay.
I think we've got it. Lunch. You could just sit in a room. That there was a time in the history of Earth when you could walk into a studio somewhere, sit down in the recording booth, look through the glass, and watch a guy playing this for the very first time. It's just, it's just a happening of such staggering proportions, I can't even really. It just weirds me out a little bit. Wow. These are Don Taylor's top five misinterpreted rock songs of all time. What might be next on this list?
Number three, Every Breath You Take, The Police.
This is another thing that I get asked to play at weddings all the time.
Yeah, I actually read an interview with Sting years ago where he said that it just really irritated him and drove him crazy that this was such a popular wedding song.
Right.
Because it's a song about an obsessive stalker. You know, it sounds a little bit like a love song, sure, but it's a song Sting wrote after separating from his first wife. In a 1983 interview, he said, I think it's a nasty little song, really rather evil. It's about jealousy and surveillance and ownership.
You can hear it, too, in the arrangement of the song. And I'm assuming that's a bass line there, that little, the thing that is driving the primary melody driver in the background, I think, is a bass. But you can hear in the way that it's produced that there's very little reverb on it, and it's played in such a tightly clipped fashion. It's a tightly wound little musical phrase that they keep turning around. In other words, that the song never, except for the bridge, except for the middle eight in the middle, the song never releases. It's this compressed sounding composition, which I think. You know, I mean, obviously, we know what it's about because he said it, but I mean, even if you didn't know, the tell that the song is about something sinister is the way that it is such a tightly gripped performance. So this is about his ex-wife?
Yes.
See, I didn't know that. I knew it was about a stalker, but I thought it was just like I thought it was just fiction, something he'd made up. So that makes this middle section actually even more interesting, because this middle section, which is the only time in the song that the dynamic releases, it's the only time in the song actually when he sounds sort of emotionally open or vulnerable, and he's talking about how he's depressed and he's sad and he's bereft. And then it immediately, so it's like a mood swing put into song form, because then he immediately goes back to this sort of restrained, constrained sound that marks the rest of the piece.
Wow.
You're not impressed with any of my
observations. I am very impressed. I'm mostly impressed because I know that you really don't like The Police. So the fact that you're giving it this much thought, it really impresses me.
I don't care. I don't like The Police as a whole. In toto, I don't really care for The Police. My friend Todd, you say that every band has one good song, no matter who they are. And The Police have more than one good song. I don't really care for The Police the way that most people do. But The Police have created... Sting has written some indisputably great songs. And I mean, this is one of those songs, too, that it's like, it is hard. I can't really remember a time when this song didn't exist.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of poor for that, because I wish that I could go back and hear this song for the first time. I wish I could hear this song never having heard it before, because it's perfect. I mean, there are very few songs, let me just say that there are very few songs you could call perfect, that you could say that have no flaws in their writing, in their performance, in their production. Sometimes you hear a great song, but it was recorded badly. Or the song is great, but the guy can't sing. There is not a single flaw in this song. Every single thing about it is perfection. And it's creepy.
Yeah, it is. It's fun to sing at karaoke, too.
Also, the thing about this song is that it's got a video that does not look dated. You watch the video for this now, it actually has retained most of its punch because it was so stark and black and white. It was just Spartan looking even then. See, there's no way I can do this in 7 minutes between Nickelback songs. It's impossible. All right. These are Don Taylor's top five misinterpreted rock and roll songs. What is next on the list?
Number two, Turning Japanese, The Vapors.
Now, see, I feel like we're playing a sort of, like it's a rope-a-dope thing now. Like it's a sort of, like you're doing a reverse psychology thing. I'm afraid to guess at what the song is really about because I feel like if...
Well, what do you think the song is about?
Well, everybody says that it's about, you know, masturbation. But
it's not.
Okay. See, so everybody thought it was about one thing, but then 10 years ago we were all told, no, it's about something else. But now you're saying it's actually not even about the something else. Blowing my mind.
For a long time, the song has been interpreted by a lot of people as being people squinting up their face during climax, during masturbation. In a VH1 True Spin special, the Vapors were asked about the song, and they explained that it's a love song about someone who lost their girlfriend and was slowly going crazy. The lead singer, Dave Fenton, said, "Turning Japanese is all the cliches about angst and youth and turning into something you didn't expect to." It was inspired by Fenton's own relationship problems.
Not a single one of these stories is better than the story we all believed.
Well, no, I think that's why we make them up.
Yeah.
Because it's more interesting. It is a great song, though.
It is. It's fantastic. This is one of those songs that I don't really care for the lyric sections, the verses, but the chorus is worth its weight in gold.
Once again, someone pipes in the text box and suggests that this list should be composed of nothing but songs by Iron Maiden.
Well done, sir. We'll do that this week. On Friday, we'll do an Iron Maiden list just for you. All right, these are the top five misinterpreted rock songs in the opinion of one Don Taylor. What is number one, Don Taylor?
The number one most misinterpreted rock song would have to be Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen.
I'll just let this kind of opening play for a second here because... There's this great story. This song gives me chills every time I hear it. I would say that this song approaches perfection as well. The only knock you could ever give this song is that at the beginning it's got that little synth line that dates it to the 80s a bit, but that's just, you know, that's like a mole on the shoulder of a beautiful woman. They tell this amazing story, and I have to tell you that I'm not a huge Springsteen fanatic in terms of knowing his music, not the way most guys. I mean, if you know Springsteen fanatics, they're like Beatles fanatics or Elvis fanatics. They're like Rush fanatics. I mean, they're just freaks about it. But I never tire of Bruce Springsteen stories or anecdotes or reading about him because he is such a fascinating character. And I just... a mind-blowingly talented songwriter, but they tell this great story about recording this song, and it's this. And I have to do this. I have to actually just go back and play it from the beginning again, so you can hear the part that I'm talking about. It's this, and where it just kind of kicks in, and it has, you know, and then the vocals come in, and then the drums pick up the regular tempo of the song, and it sort of, you know, and it sort of reaches its sort of full flower. They tell the story about recording this the first night in the studio when they had really put it all together. And they played just the music to this, where it was just doing this keyboard line over and over again for like 2.5 hours. Because they said it was just the most glorious thing that any of them had ever heard when the song really sort of got going.
And also, Springsteen had just finished spending something like 5 hours doing vocals on one of the other songs on the album. And they decided to run this anyway, even though his voice was starting to go. And he decided he really liked the raspy quality that he was getting because his voice was almost shot at that point.
Yeah.
And they decided to keep it.
They called John Landau, who was his manager, at home. And Lando says that he checked his messages, he checked his answering machine the next day, and in the background was just this music going on for like 17 minutes as Bruce and the band just continued to play this over and over again because they said that they realized they were sort of in the moment. And so rarely in a band, I think, do you recognize when you've really created something that's magical, and it happens so infrequently. But they sort of knew at that moment that, you know, what they'd done here.
Well, yeah, this is a song that is widely misinterpreted as being about American pride. And it's actually a song about a very kind of a bitter song about the problems that Vietnam veterans face when they return. Vietnam being the first war that the USA didn't win. And while veterans of other wars received a hero's welcome home, people who fought in Vietnam were widely, you know, ignored and not really given a lot of lauds and plaudits and such when they got there. Also, Springsteen hates how widely misinterpreted the song has been, and took. I don't know if he still does it, but for a number of years, he would play it acoustically,
like a slowed down,
and very slow, because he wanted people to listen to the lyrics.
This moment coming up here, where he talks about, in the way that only he really nails, where he talks about it in the shadow of the refinery. I mean, this is such an overused phrase about him, but really, there is no more musical equivalent to John Steinbeck than Springsteen. I mean, it's
his Nebraska album is one of the finest albums that
it's one of the best things
ever been recorded.
I have a listener who is a Springsteen fanatic who gave me a 5-hour CD collection called "The Story" or "How Nebraska Was Born." Tracking the evolution of Nebraska, which, you know, they had meant to release as an acoustic or as an electric album, and they tried it repeatedly and they couldn't ever do it, but he had some bootlegs of the electric version of Nebraska, which is just I am such a huge fan of Springsteen, even though his music, there's so much of it and he's so prolific, it's like you could just spend your whole life listening to nothing but Springsteen and never really get it all done. And I think we're coming up on just the we're gonna wrap the show up here in a few, but we're coming up on this moment where I think they bring the song. Have I already missed it? Where they bring the song down. It's right here where they go back to the keyboard. This was the section where they said they eventually faded out because they just played it for like 2 hours because they couldn't get over how fantastic it sounded. What a big, amazing, majestic, martial sound it had. You know, and if, I mean,
beautiful drums.
Yeah,
just gorgeous drums.
And just, yeah, the Max Weinberg, the way he drums and then the sound they get where it's, you can tell that it is very clearly, I'm a huge fan of record production. And one of the things about that song is you can tell that it was a bunch of guys in a room together. I mean, yeah, they do, you know, back do overdubs and they do backing vocals and whatever. But, you know, but everybody tries to, you know, pass this off. Well, we just get around the microphone and with a few chords and the truth and we just play what, you know, our hearts out. And that's never true. Nobody ever does that. But you listen to Springsteen and you can hear some of those songs that they really obviously were just all recorded in essentially live takes, at least large sections of the song. So, wow. I could talk about that for hours on end. All right. Jesus, what time is it? It's 3:15. All right, we got to wrap this up. Not because we couldn't talk all day. We could.
Obviously, we could.
We really, we just own the whole joint here, so we could do that if we wanted to. But the places to go and people to see and so forth. Coming up tomorrow on the Rick Emerson Radio Program, we will have more amusements for you. We will get to our Britney watch tomorrow, have another installment of Pop Culture Authority, and so forth. Something else I was going to say that seemed massively important. This final, I meant to do this at the top of the show, so I'll do it again tomorrow at the top of the show, but you're going to hear it now as a sneak preview, is my way of saying thank you for listening on this holiday. The Rick Emerson live stream, which ran all weekend long, it was 24 hours at rickemerson.com. It was just, I think, from Saturday at like midnight or something all the way up until now, actually. We never turned it off. We got such a great response to that over the weekend of just running the live stream nonstop that is going to be a thing we continue. As of now, the Rick Emerson show and the Rick Emerson stream will be running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. with all manner of things, not only all the shows that we've done since we came here on the 21st, but shows from the archives as well, and various things that we played, I think, Behind the Christmas a couple times over the weekend. So all of that stuff will go into a rotation, and it's going to be running 24 hours a day as of now right here at rickemerson.com. So if you have not had a chance to listen, this is going to be your chance to do so, and if you haven't given somebody a gift subscription, you can do that as well at rickemerson.com/gift. We want to thank our guest, Mr. Siegfried Zeliger, here talking about Grindhouse Trailer Spectacular 2, as well as David Walker from badassmofo.com. Thank you for listening. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, right here above the Milk Packing District in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Hagler, and our chief of staff is Cheryl Kenekoa. The Rick Emerson Show, of course, made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Monday, July 5th, 2010, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.